CD4.
Century City, Monday, September 27th, 9:45 a.m. Evans had heard nothing from Morton for almost 2 weeks. He could not remember ever having gone so long without contact with his client. He had lunch with Sarah, who was visibly anxious. "Do you hear from him at all?" he said. "Not a word." "What do the pilots say?"
"They're in Van Nuys. He's rented a different plane. I don't know where he is."
"And he's coming back?"
She shrugged. "Who knows?"
And so it was with considerable surprise that he received Sarah's call that day.
"You better get going," she said. "George wants to see you right away."
"Where?"
"At NERF in Beverly Hills." "He's back?" "I'll say."
It was a 10-minute drive from his offices in Century City to the NERF building. Of course, the National Environmental Resource Fund was headquartered in Washington, D.C., but they had recently opened a West Coast office in Beverly Hills. Cynics claimed that NERF had done it to be closer to the Hollywood celebrities who were so essential to their fundraising. But that was just gossip. Evans half expected to find Morton pacing outside, but he was nowhere in sight. Evans went into the reception area and was told that Morton was in the third-floor conference room. He walked up to the third floor. The conference room was glass-walled on two sides. The interior was furnished with a large boardroom-style table and 18 chairs. There was an audiovisual unit in the corner for presentations. Evans saw three people in the conference room and an argument in progress. Morton stood at the front of the room, red-faced, gesticulating. Drake was also standing, pacing back and forth, pointing an angry finger at Morton and shouting back at him. Evans also saw John Henley, the Saturnine head of PR for NERF. He was bent over, making notes on a yellow legal pad. It was clearly an argument between Morton and Drake. Evans was not sure what to do, so he stood there. After a moment, Morton saw him and made a quick jabbing motion, indicating that Evans should sit down outside. He did. He watched the argument through the glass. It turned out there was a fourth person in the room as well. Evans hadn't seen him at first because he was hunched down behind the podium, but when that person stood, Evans saw a workman in clean, neatly pressed overalls carrying a briefcase-style toolbox with a couple of electronic meters clipped to his belt. On his chest pocket, a logo read AV Network Systems. The workman looked confused. Apparently, Drake didn't want the workman in the room during the argument, whereas Morton seemed to like an audience. Drake wanted the guy to go. Morton insisted he stay. Caught in the middle, the workman looked uncomfortable and ducked down out of sight again. But soon after, Drake prevailed and the workman left. As the workman walked past him, Evans said, "Rough day?" The workman shrugged. "They've got a lot of network problems in this building," he said. "Myself, I think it's bad Ethernet cable. Or the routers are overheating." And he walked on. Back inside, the argument raged, fiercer than ever. It continued for another 5 minutes. The glass was almost entirely soundproof, but from time to time, when they shouted, Evans could hear a phrase. He heard Morton yell, "God damn it, I want to win!" And he heard Drake reply, "It's just too risky," which made Morton even angrier. And later Morton said, "Don't we have to fight for the most important issue facing our planet?" And Drake answered, something about being practical or facing reality. And Morton said, "Fuck reality!" At which point the PR guy, Henley, glanced up and said, "My sentiments exactly," or something like that. Evans had the distinct impression that this argument concerned the Vanuatu lawsuit, but it seemed to range over a number of other subjects as well. And then, quite abruptly, Morton came out, slamming the door so hard that the glass wall shook. "Fuck those guys!" Evans fell into step with his client.
Through the glass, he saw the other two men huddle, whispering together.
Fuck 'em!
George said loudly. He paused and looked back.
If we have right on our side, shouldn't we be telling the truth?
Inside, Drake just shook his head sorrowfully.
Fuck 'em!
Morton said again, walking off. Evans said, You wanted me here?
Yes!
Morton pointed.
You know who that other guy was?
Yes, he said, John Henley.
Correct! Those two guys are Nerf, George said. I don't care how many celebrity trustees they have on their letterhead, or how many lawyers they keep on staff. Those two run the show, and everyone else rubber stamps. None of the trustees really knows anything about what is going on. Otherwise, they wouldn't be a part of this. And let me tell you, I'm not going to be a part of this. Not anymore!
They started walking down the stairs. Meaning what? Evans said to him.
Meaning, Morton said, I am not giving them that $10 million grant for the lawsuit.
You told them that?
No,
he said.
I did not tell them that. And you will not tell them that either. I think I'll let it be a surprise. For later.
He smiled grimly.
But draw up the papers now.
Are you sure about this, George?
Don't piss me off, kid.
I'm just asking.
I said draw up the papers, so do it.
Evans said he would.
Today!
Evans said he would do it at once. Evans waited until they got to the parking garage before he spoke again. He walked Morton to his waiting town car. His driver, Harry, opened the door for him. Evans said, George, you have that Nerf banquet honoring you next week. Is that still going ahead?
Absolutely, Morton said. I wouldn't miss it for the world.
He got in the car and Harry closed the door. Good day, sir, Harry said to Evans. And the car drove off into the morning sunlight. He called from his car. Sarah?
I know.
What is going on?
He won't tell me, but he's really angry, Peter, really angry.
I got that impression.
And he just left again.
What?
He left. He said he would be back in a week, in time to fly everybody up to San Francisco for the banquet.
Drake called Evans's cell phone. What is going on, Peter?
I have no idea, Nick. The man's demented. The things he was saying.
Could you hear him?
No, actually.
He's demented. I am really worried about him. I mean, as a friend. To say nothing of our banquet next week. I mean, is he going to be all right?
I think so.
He's taking a plane load of friends up there.
Are you sure?
That's what Sarah says.
Can I talk to George? Can you set something up?
My understanding, Evans said, is that he just went out of town again.
It's that damn Kenner. He's behind all this.
I don't know what's going on with George, Nick. All I know is he's coming to the banquet.
I want you to promise me you'll deliver him.
Nick, Evans said, George does what he wants.
That's what I'm afraid of.
To San Francisco, Monday, October 4th, 1:38 p.m. Flying up in his Gulfstream, Morton brought several of the most prominent celebrity supporters of Nerf. These included two rock stars, the wife of a comedian, an actor who played the president on a television series, a writer who had recently run for governor, and two environmental lawyers from other firms. Over white wine and smoked salmon canapés, the discussion became quite lively, focusing on what the United States, as the world's leading economy, should be doing to promote environmental sanity. Uncharacteristically, Morton did not join in. Instead, he slumped in the back of the plane, looking irritable and gloomy. Evans sat beside him, keeping him company. Morton was drinking straight vodka. He was already on his second.
I brought the papers canceling your grant, Evans said, taking them out of his briefcase. If you still want to do this.
I do.
Morton scribbled his signature, hardly looking at the documents. He said,
Keep those safe until tomorrow.
He looked back at his guests,
who are now trading statistics on species loss as the rainforests of the world were cut down. Off to one side, Ted Bradley, the actor who played the president, was talking about how he preferred his electric car, which he pointed out he had owned for many years now, to the new hybrids that were so popular.
"There's no comparison," he was saying. "The hybrids are nice, but they're not the real thing."
At the center table, Anne Garner, who sat on the boards of environmental organizations, was arguing that Los Angeles needed to build more public transportation so that people could get out of their cars. "Americans," she said, "belched out more carbon dioxide than any other people on the planet, and it was disgraceful." Anne was the beautiful wife of a famous attorney, and always intense, especially on environmental issues. Morton sighed. He turned to Evans.
"Do you know how much pollution we're creating right this minute? We'll burn 450 gallons of aviation fuel to take 12 people to San Francisco. Just by making this trip, they're generating more pollution per capita than most people on the planet will generate in a year."
He finished his vodka and rattled the ice in the glass irritably. He handed the glass to Evans, who dutifully signaled for more.
"If there's anything worse than a limousine liberal," Morton said, "it's a Gulfstream environmentalist."
"But George," Evans said, "you're a Gulfstream environmentalist."
"I know it," Morton said, "and I wish it bothered me more. But you know what? It doesn't. I like flying around in my own airplane."
Evans said, "I heard you were in North Dakota and Chicago."
"I was, yes."
"What'd you do there?"
"I spent money. A lot of money. A lot."
Evans said, "You bought some art?"
"No. I bought something far more expensive than art. I bought integrity."
"You've always had integrity," Evans said.
"No, not my integrity," Morton said. "I bought somebody else's."
Evans didn't know what to say to that. For a minute, he thought Morton was joking.
"I was going to tell you about it," Morton continued. "I got a list of numbers, kid, and I want you to get it to Kenner. It is very much for later." "Hello, Anne!"
Anne Garner was coming toward him. "So, George, are you back for a while? Because we need you here now. The Vanuatu lawsuit, which thank God you are backing, and the climate change conference that Nick has scheduled. And it's so important. My God, George, this is crunch time."
Evan started to stand to let Anne take his seat, but Morton pushed him back down again. "Anne," he said, "I must say you look more lovely than ever, but Peter and I are having a small business discussion."
She glanced at the papers and Evans's open briefcase. "Oh, I didn't know I was interrupting."
"No, no, no. If you just give us a minute."
"Of course. I'm sorry." But she lingered. "This is so unlike you, George, doing business on the plane."
"I know," Morton said. "But if you must know, I am feeling quite unlike myself these days."
That made her blink. She didn't know how to take it. So she smiled, nodded, and moved away. Morton said,
"She looks wonderful. I wonder who did her work."
"Her work?
She's had more in the last few months. I think eyes. Maybe chin. Anyway," he said, waving his hand, "about the list of numbers. You are to tell this to no one, Peter, no one. Not anyone in the law firm, and especially not anyone." "George, damn it! Why are you hiding back there?"
Evans looked over his shoulder and saw Ted Bradley coming toward them. Ted was already drinking heavily, though it was only noon.
"It hasn't been the same without you, George. My God! The world without Bradley is a boring world. Oops! I mean, without George Morton is a boring world. Come on, George."
Get up out of there! That man is a lawyer. Come and have a drink.
Morton allowed himself to be led away. He glanced over his shoulder at Evans. Later, he said.
San Francisco, Monday, October 4th, 9:02 p.m. The grand ballroom of the Mark Hopkins Hotel was darkened for the after-dinner speeches. The audience was elegant. The men in tuxedos, the women in ball gowns. Beneath the ornate chandeliers, the voice of Nicholas Drake boomed from the podium. Ladies and gentlemen, it is no exaggeration to say that we face an environmental crisis of unprecedented proportions. Our forests are disappearing. Our lakes and rivers are polluted. The plants and animals that make up our biosphere are vanishing at unprecedented rates. 40,000 species become extinct every year. That's 50 species every single day. At present rates, we will lose half of all species on our planet in the next few decades. It is the greatest extinction in the history of Earth. And what is the texture of our own lives? Our food is contaminated with lethal pesticides. Our crops are failing from global warming. Our weather is getting worse and more severe. Flooding, droughts, hurricanes, tornadoes, all around the globe. Our sea levels are rising, 25 feet in the next century, and possibly more. And most fearsome of all, new scientific evidence points to the specter of abrupt climate change as a result of our destructive behavior. In short, ladies and gentlemen, we are confronted by a genuine global catastrophe for our planet. Sitting at the center table, Peter Evans looked around at the audience. They were staring down at their plates, yawning, leaning over and talking to one another. Drake wasn't getting a lot of attention.
They've heard it before,
Morton growled.
He shifted his heavy frame and gave a soft belch. He had been drinking steadily through the evening and was now quite drunk.
Loss of biodiversity, shrinking of habitat, destruction of the ozone layer.
Nicholas Drake appeared tall and ungainly, his tuxedo ill-fitting. The collar of his shirt was bunched up around his scrawny neck. As always, he gave the impression of an impoverished but dedicated academic, a latter-day Ichabod Crane.
Evans thought no one would ever guess that Drake was paid $250,000 a year to head the fund, plus another $100,000 in expenses, or that he had no science background at all. Drake was a trial attorney, one of five who had started NERF many years before. And like all trial attorneys, he knew the importance of not dressing too well.
The erosion of bioreservoirs, the rise of ever more exotic and lethal diseases.
I wish he'd hurry up,
Morton said. He drummed his fingers on the table. Evans said nothing. He had attended enough of these functions to know that Morton was always tense if he had to speak. At the podium, Drake was saying, glimmers of hope, faint rays of positive energy, and none more positive and hopeful than the man whose lifelong dedication we are here to honor tonight.
Can I get another drink?
Morton said, finishing the last of his martini. It was his sixth. He set the glass on the table with a thud. Evans turned to look for the waiter, raising his hand. He was hoping the waiter wouldn't come over in time. George had had enough.
For three decades has dedicated his considerable resources and energy to making our world a better, healthier, saner place. Ladies and gentlemen, the National Environmental Resource Fund is proud...
Ah, screw, never mind,
Morton said. He tensed his body, ready to push back from the table.
I hate making a fool of myself, even for a good cause.
Why should you make a fool? Evans began.
My good friend and colleague, and this year's concerned citizen, Mr. George Morton.
The room filled with applause, and a spotlight hit Morton as he stood and headed toward the podium. A hunched bear of a man, physically powerful, solemn, head down. Evans was alarmed when Morton stumbled on the first step, and for a moment he feared his boss would fall backward. But Morton regained his balance, and as he stepped to the stage, he seemed all right. He shook hands with Drake and moved to the podium, gripping it on both sides with his huge hands. Morton looked out at the room, turning his head from side to side, surveying the audience. He did not speak. He just stood there and said nothing. Ann Garner, sitting beside Evans, gave him a nudge.
Is he all right?
Oh, yes, absolutely, Evans said, nodding. But in truth, he wasn't sure. Finally, George Morton began to speak.
I'd like to thank Nicholas Drake and the National Environmental Resource Fund for this award. But I don't feel I deserve it. Not with all the work that remains to be done. Do you know, my friends, that we know more about the moon than we do about the Earth's oceans? That's a real environmental problem. We don't know enough about the planet we depend on for our very lives. But as Montaigne said 300 years ago, nothing is so firmly believed as that which is least known.
Evans thought, Montaigne? George Morton quoting Montaigne? In the glare of the spotlight, Morton was distinctly weaving back and forth. He was gripping the podium for balance. The room was absolutely silent. People were not moving at all. Even the waiters had stopped moving between the tables. Evans held his breath.
All of us in the environmental movement, Morton said, have seen many wonderful victories over the years. We have witnessed the creation of the EPA. We have seen the air and water made cleaner, sewage treatment improved, toxic dumps cleaned up, and we have regulated common poisons like lead for the safety of all. These are real victories, my friends. We take justifiable pride in them. And we know more needs to be done.
The audience was relaxing. Morton was moving on to familiar ground.
But will the work get done? I am not sure. I know my mood has been dark since the death of my beloved wife, Dorothy.
Evan sat bolt upright in his chair. At the next table, Herb Lowenstein looked shocked. His mouth open. George Morton had no wife. Or rather, he had six ex-wives, none named Dorothy.
Dorothy urged me to spend my money wisely. I always thought I did. Now I am less sure. I said before that we don't know enough. But I fear that today the watchword of NERF has become we don't sue enough.
You could hear breath sucked in sharply all around the room.
NERF is a law firm. I don't know if you realize that. It was started by lawyers and it is run by lawyers. But I now believe money is better spent on research than litigation. And that is why I am withdrawing my funding for NERF. And why I am...
For the next few moments, Morton could not be heard above the excited jabber of the crowd. Everyone was talking loudly. There were scattered boos. Some guests got up to leave. Morton continued to talk, seemingly oblivious to the effect he was having. Evans caught a few phrases.
One environmental charity is under FBI investigation. Complete lack of oversight.
Ann Garner leaned over and hissed,
"Get him off there." "What do you want me to do?"
Evans whispered.
"Go and get him. He's obviously drunk." "That may be, but I can't. You have to stop this."
But on the stage, Drake was already moving forward, saying,
"All right. Thank you, George."
Because to tell the truth right now...
Thank you, George,
Drake said again, moving closer. He was actually pushing against Morton's bulk, trying to shove him away from the podium.
Okay, okay, Morton said, clinging to the podium. I said what I did for Dorothy, my dear dead wife.
Thank you, George.
Drake was applauding now, holding his hands up at head height, nodding to the audience to join with him.
Thank you.
Who I miss desperately.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in
Yeah, okay, I'm leaving.
To muted applause, Morton shambled off the stage. Drake immediately stepped up to the podium and signaled the band. They started into a rousing rendition of Billy Joel's You May Be Right, which someone had told them was Morton's favorite song. It was, but it seemed a poor choice under the circumstances. Herb Lowenstein leaned over from the next table and grabbed Evans by the shoulder, pulling him close.
Listen,
he whispered fiercely.
Get him out of here.
I will, Evans said. Don't worry.
Did you know this was going to happen?
No, I swear to God. Lowenstein released Evans just as George Morton returned to the table. The assembled group was stunned. But Norton was singing cheerfully with the music.
You may be right. I may be crazy.
Come on, George, Evans said, standing up. Let's get out of here. Morton ignored him.
But it just may be a lunatic you're looking for.
George, what do you say? Evans took him by the arm. Let's go.
Turn out the lights. Don't try to say.
I'm not trying to save you, Evans said.
Then how about another damn martini? Morton said,
no longer singing. His eyes were cold, a little resentful.
I think I fucking earned it.
Harry will have one for you in the car, Evans said, steering Morton away from the table. If you stay here, you will have to wait for it, and you don't want to wait for a drink right now. Evans continued talking, and Morton allowed himself to be led out of the room.
Too late to fight, he sang. Too late to change.
Before they could get out of the room, there was a TV camera with light shining in their faces, and two reporters shoving small tape recorders in front of Morton. Everybody was yelling questions. Evans put his head down and said, Excuse us, sorry, coming through, excuse us. Morton never stopped singing. They made their way through the hotel lobby. The reporters were running in front of them, trying to get some distance ahead so they could film them walking forward. Evans gripped Morton firmly by the elbows as Morton sang,
I was only having fun, wasn't hurting anyone, and we all enjoyed the weekend for a change.
This way, Evans said, heading for the door.
I was stranded in the combat zone.
And then at last they were through the swinging doors and outside in the night. Morton stopped singing abruptly when the cold air hit him. They waited for his limousine to pull around. Sarah came out and stood beside Morton. She didn't say anything. She just put her hand on his arm. Then the reporters came out, and the lights came on again. And then Drake burst through the door saying,
God damn it, George!
He broke off when he saw the cameras. He glared at Morton, turned, and went back inside. The cameras remained on, but the three of them just stood there. It was awkward, just waiting. After what seemed like an eternity, the limousine pulled up. Harry came around and opened the door for George.
Okay, George, Evans said.
Nope, not tonight.
Harry's waiting, George.
I said not tonight.
There was a deep-throated growl in the darkness, and a silver Ferrari convertible pulled up alongside the limousine.
My car,
Morton said. He started down the stairs, lurching a bit. Sarah said, George, I don't think... But he was singing again.
And you told me not to drive, but I made it home alive. So you said that only proves that I'm insane.
One of the reporters muttered, He's insane, all right. Evans followed Morton, very concerned. Morton gave the parking attendant a $100 bill, saying,
"A 20 for you, my good man."
He fumbled with the Ferrari door.
"These crummy Italian imports."
Then he got behind the wheel of the convertible, gunned the engine, and smiled.
"Ah, a manly sound."
Evans leaned over the car. "George, let Harry drive you. Besides," he added, "don't we need to talk about something?"
"We do not."
"But I thought..."
"Kid, get out of my way."
The camera lights were still on them, but Morton moved so that he was in the shadow cast by Evans's body.
"You know, the Buddhists have a saying."
"What saying?"
"Remember it, kid. Goes like this. All that matters is not remote from where the Buddha sits."
"George, I really think you should not be driving."
"Will you remember what I just said to you?"
"Yes."
"Wisdom of the ages. Goodbye, kid."
And he accelerated, roaring out of the parking lot as Evans jumped back. The Ferrari squealed around the corner, ignoring a stop sign, and was gone. "Peter, come on!" Evans turned and saw Sarah standing by the limousine. Harry was getting in behind the wheel. Evans got in the back seat with Sarah, and they drove off after Morton. The Ferrari turned left at the bottom of the hill, disappearing around the corner. Harry accelerated, handling the huge limousine with skill. Evans said,
"Do you know where he's going?"
"No idea," she said. "Who wrote his speech?"
"He did."
"Really?" "He was working in the house all day yesterday, and he wouldn't let me see what he was doing."
"Jesus,"
Evans said.
"Montaigne?"
"He had a book of quotations out."
"Where'd he come up with Dorothy?"
She shook her head. "I have no idea." They passed Golden Gate Park. Traffic was light. The Ferrari was moving fast, weaving among the cars. Ahead was the Golden Gate Bridge, brightly lit in the night. Morton accelerated. The Ferrari was going almost 90 miles an hour.
"He's going to Marin," Sarah said.
Evans' cell phone rang. It was Drake.
"Will you tell me what the hell that was all about?"
"I'm sorry, Nick. I don't know."
"Was he serious? About withdrawing his support?"
"I think he was."
"That's unbelievable. He's obviously suffered a nervous breakdown."
"I couldn't say."
"I was afraid of this,"
Drake said.
"I was afraid something like this might happen. You remember on the plane coming back from Iceland? I said it to you, and you told me I shouldn't worry. Is that your opinion now? That I shouldn't worry?"
"I don't know what you're asking, Nick.
Ann Garner said he signed some papers on the plane."
"That's right, he did."
"Are they related to this sudden and inexplicable withdrawal of support for the organization that he loved and cherished?"
"He seems to have changed his mind about that," Evans said.
"And why didn't you tell me?"
"He instructed me not to."
"Fuck you, Evans!"
"I'm sorry," Evans said.
"Not as sorry as you will be."
The phone went dead. Drake had hung up. Evans flipped the phone shut. Sarah said, "Drake is mad?"
"Furious."
Off the bridge, Morton headed west, away from the lights of the freeway, onto a dark road skirting the cliffs. He was driving faster than ever. Evans said to Harry, "Do you know where we are?"
"I believe we're in a state park."
Harry was trying to keep up, but on this narrow, twisting road, the limousine was no match for the Ferrari. It moved farther and farther ahead. Soon they could see only the taillights, disappearing around curves a quarter mile ahead.
"We're going to lose him," Evans said.
"I doubt it, sir."
But the limousine fell steadily behind. After Harry took one turn too fast, the big rear end lost traction and swung wide toward a cliff's edge. They were obliged to slow down even more. They were in a desolate area now. The night was dark and the cliffs deserted. A rising moon put a streak of silver on the black water far below. Up ahead, they no longer saw any taillights. It seemed they were alone on the dark road. They came around a curve and saw the next curve 100 yards ahead, obscured by billowing gray smoke.
"Oh, no,"
Sarah said, putting her hand to her mouth. The Ferrari had spun out, struck a tree, and flipped over. Now it lay upside down, a crumpled and smoking mass. It had very nearly gone off the cliff itself. The nose of the car was hanging over the edge. Evans and Sarah ran forward. Evans got down on his hands and knees and crawled along the cliff's edge, trying to see into the driver's compartment. It was hard to see much of anything. The front windshield was flattened, and the Ferrari lay almost flush to the pavement. Harry came over with a flashlight, and Evans used it to peer inside. The compartment was empty. Morton's black bow tie was dangling from the doorknob, but otherwise he was gone. He must have been thrown. Evans shone the light down the cliff. It was crumbling yellow rock, descending steeply for 80 feet to the ocean below. He saw no sign of Morton. Sarah was crying softly. Harry had gone back to get a fire extinguisher from the limousine. Evans swung his light back and forth over the rock face. He did not see George's body. In fact, he did not see any sign of George at all. No disturbance, no path, no bits of clothing, nothing. Behind him, he heard the whoosh of the fire extinguisher. He crawled away from the cliff's edge.
"Did you see him, sir?"
Harry said, his face full of pain. "No, I didn't see anything."
"Perhaps over there."
Harry pointed toward the tree, and he was right. If Morton had been thrown from the car by the initial impact, he might be 20 yards back on the road. Evans walked back and shone his flashlight down the cliff again. The battery was running down. The beam was weakening. But almost immediately he saw a glint of light off a man's patent leather slipper, wedged among the rocks at the edge of the water. He sat down in the road and put his head in his hands and cried. Point Moody, Tuesday, October 5th, 3:10 a.m. By the time the police were finished talking with him, and a rescue team had rappelled down the cliff to recover the shoe, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. They found no other sign of the body, and the cops, talking among themselves, agreed that the prevailing currents would probably carry the body up the coast to Pismo Beach.
"We'll find him," one said, "in about a week or so. Or at least, what's left by the great whites."
Now the wreck had been cleared away and loaded onto a flatbed truck. Evans wanted to leave, but the highway patrolman who had taken Evans's statement kept coming back to ask for more details. He was a kid in his early 20s. It seemed he had not filled out many of these forms before. The first time he came back to Evans and said, "How soon after the accident would you say you arrived on the scene?" Evans said, "I'm not sure. The Ferrari was about 1/2 mile ahead of us, maybe more. We were probably going 40 miles an hour, so maybe a minute later." The kid looked alarmed.
"You were going 40 in that limo? On this road?"
"Well, don't hold me to it." Then he came back and said,
"You said you were the first on the scene. You told me you crawled around at the edge of the road."
"That's right."
"So you would have stepped on broken glass on the road?"
"Yes. The windshield was shattered. I had it on my hands, too, when I crouched down."
"So that explains why the glass was disturbed."
"Yes."
"Lucky you didn't cut your hands."
"Yes."
The third time he came back, he said, "In your estimation, what time did the accident occur?"
"What time?" Evans looked at his watch. I have no idea. But let me see. He tried to work backward. The speech must have started about 8:30. Morton would have left the hotel at 9. Through San Francisco, then over the bridge. Maybe 9:45 or 10 at night. So, 5 hours ago, roughly. Yes? The kid said, huh, as if he were surprised. Evans looked over at the flatbed truck, which now held the crumpled remains of the Ferrari. The cop was standing on the flatbed, beside the car. Three other cops were on the street, talking with some animation. There was another man there, wearing a tuxedo. He was talking to the cops. When the man turned, Evans was surprised to see that it was John Kenner. What's going on? Evans asked the kid. I don't know. They just asked me to check on the time of the accident. Then the driver got into the flatbed truck and started the engine. One of the cops yelled to the kid, "Forget it, Eddie!" "Never mind, then," the kid said to Evans. "I guess everything's okay." Evans looked over at Sarah to see if she had noticed Kenner. She was leaning on the limousine, talking on the phone. Evans looked back in time to see Kenner get into a dark sedan driven by the Nepali guy and drive off. The cops were leaving. The flatbed turned around and headed up the road toward the bridge. Harry said, "Looks like it's time to go." Evans got into the limousine. They drove back toward the lights of San Francisco. To Los Angeles, Tuesday, October 5th, 12:02 p.m. Morton's jet flew back to Los Angeles at noon. The mood was somber. All the same people were on board, and a few more, but they sat quietly, saying little. The late edition papers had printed the story that millionaire philanthropist George Morton, depressed by the death of his beloved wife Dorothy, had given a disjointed speech, termed rambling and illogical by the San Francisco Chronicle, and a few hours later had died in a tragic automobile crash while test driving his new Ferrari. In the third paragraph, the reporter mentioned that single-car fatalities were frequently caused by undiagnosed depression and were often disguised suicides. And this, according to a quoted psychiatrist, was the likely explanation for Morton's death. About 10 minutes into the flight, the actor Ted Bradley said, "I think we should drink a toast in memory of George and observe a minute of silence," and to a chorus of "Hear, hear!" glasses of champagne were passed all around. "To George Morton," Ted said, "a great American, a great friend, and a great supporter of the environment, we and the planet will miss him." For the next 10 minutes, the celebrities on board remained relatively subdued. But slowly the conversation picked up, and finally they began to talk and argue as usual. Evans was sitting in the back, in the same seat he had occupied when they flew up. He watched the action at the table in the center, where Bradley was now explaining that the U.S. got only 2% of its energy from sustainable sources, and that we needed a crash program to build thousands of offshore wind farms, like England and Denmark were doing. The talk moved on to fuel cells, hydrogen cars, and photovoltaic households running off the grid. Some talked about how much they loved their hybrid cars, which they had bought for their staff to drive. Evans felt his spirits improve as he listened to them. Despite the loss of George Morton, there were still lots of people like these, famous, high-profile people committed to change, who would lead the next generation to a more enlightened future. He started to drift off to sleep when Nicholas Drake dropped into the seat beside his. Drake leaned across the aisle. "Listen," he said, "I owe you an apology for last night." "That's all right," Evans said. I was way out of line. And I want you to know I'm sorry for how I behaved. I was upset and very worried. You know, George has been acting weird as hell the last couple of weeks. Talking strangely, picking fights. I guess in retrospect he was beginning to have a nervous breakdown. But I didn't know, did you? I'm not sure it was a nervous breakdown. It must have been, Drake said. What else could it have been? My God, the man disowns his life's work and then goes out and kills himself? By the way, you can forget about any documents that he signed yesterday. Under the circumstances, he obviously was not in his right mind. And I know, he added, that you wouldn't argue the point differently. You're already conflicted enough, doing work both for him and for us. You really should have recused yourself and seen to it that any papers were drawn up by a neutral attorney. I'm not going to accuse you of malpractice, but you've shown highly questionable judgment. Evans said nothing. The threat was plain enough. Well, anyway, Drake said, resting his hand on Evans's knee, I just wanted to apologize. I know you did your best with a difficult situation, Peter, and I think we're going to come out of this all right. The plane landed in Van Nuys. A dozen black SUV limos, the latest fashion, were lined up on the runway waiting for the passengers. All the celebrities hugged, kissed air, and departed. Evans was the last to leave. He didn't rate a car and driver. He climbed into his little Prius hybrid, which he'd parked there the day before, and drove through the gates and onto the freeway. He thought he should go to the office, but unexpected tears came to his eyes as he negotiated the midday traffic. He wiped them away and decided he was too damn tired to go to the office. Instead, he would go back to his apartment to get some sleep. He was almost home when his cell phone rang. It was Jennifer Haynes at the Venutu litigation team. I'm sorry about George, she said. It's just terrible. Everybody here is very upset, as you can imagine. He pulled the funding, didn't he? Yes, but Nick will fight it. You'll get your funding. We need to have lunch, she said. Well, I think today. Something in her voice made him say, I'll try. Phone me when you're here. He hung up. The phone rang again almost immediately. It was Margot Lane, Morton's mistress. She was angry. What the fuck is going on? What do you mean? Evans said. Was anybody going to fucking call me? I'm sorry, Margot. I just saw it on TV. Missing in San Francisco and presumed dead. They had pictures of the car. I was going to call you, Evans said, when I got to my office. The truth was, she had completely slipped his mind. And when would that would have been? Next week? You're as bad as that sick assistant of yours. You're his lawyer, Peter. Do your fucking job. Because you know, let's face it, this is not a surprise. I knew this was going to happen. We all did. I want you to come over here. I have a busy day. Just for a minute. All right, he said. Just for a minute. West Los Angeles, Tuesday, October 5th, 3:04 p.m. Margot Lane lived on the 15th floor of a high-rise apartment building in the Wilshire corridor. The doorman had called up before Evans was allowed in the elevator. Margot knew he was coming up, but she still answered the door wrapped in a towel. Oh, I didn't realize you'd be here so soon. Come in. I just got out of the shower. She frequently did something like this, flaunting her body. Evans came into the apartment and sat on the couch. She sat opposite him. The towel barely covered her torso. So, she said, what's all this about George? I'm sorry, Evans said. But George crashed his Ferrari at a very high speed and was thrown from the car. He fell down a cliff. They found a shoe at the bottom and into the water. His body hasn't been recovered,
but they expect it will turn up in a week or so. With her love of drama, he was sure Margot would start to cry, but she didn't. She just stared at him. "That's bullshit," she said. "Why do you say that, Margot?" "Because he's hiding or something. You know it." "Hiding? From what?" "Probably nothing. He'd become completely paranoid. You know that." As she said it, she crossed her legs. Evans was careful to keep his eyes on her face. "Paranoid?" he asked. "Don't act like you didn't know, Peter. It was obvious." Evans shook his head. "Not to me." "The last time he came here was a couple of days ago," she said. "He went right to the window and stood back behind the curtain, looking down onto the street. He was convinced he was being followed."
"Had he done that before?"
"I don't know. I hadn't seen him much lately. He was traveling. But whenever I called him and asked when he was coming over, he said it wasn't safe to come here." Evans got up and walked to the window. He stood to one side and looked down at the street below. "Are you being followed too?" she said.
"I don't think so."
Traffic on Wilshire Boulevard was heavy, the start of afternoon rush hour. Three lanes of cars moving fast in each direction. He could hear the roar of the traffic, even up there. But there was no place to park, to pull out from the traffic. A blue Prius hybrid had pulled to the curb across the street, and traffic was backing up behind it, honking. After a moment, the Prius started up again. No place to stop. "Do you see anything suspicious?" she asked. "No, I never did either. But George did, or thought he did." "Did he say who was following him?" "No." She shifted again. "I thought he should have medication. I told him."
"And what did he say to that?"
"He said I was in danger, too. He told me I should leave town for a while, go visit my sister in Oregon, but I won't." Her towel was coming loose. Margot tightened it, lowering it across her firm, enhanced breasts. "So I'm telling you, George went into hiding," she said. "And I think you better find him fast, because the man needs help."
"I see," Evans said. "But I suppose it's possible he isn't in hiding, that he really crashed his car.
In which case, there are things you need to do now, Margot." He explained to her that if George remained missing, his assets would be ordered frozen, which meant that she ought to withdraw everything from the bank account into which he put money for her every month, so she would be sure to have money to live on. "But that's silly," she protested. "I know he'll be back in a few days."
"Just in case," Evans said.
She frowned. "Do you know something you're not telling me?"
"No," Evans said. "I'm just saying it could be a while before this thing gets cleared up."
"Look," she said, "he's sick. You're supposed to be his friend. Find him."
Evans said that he would try.
When he left, Margot was flouncing off to the bedroom to get dressed before going to the bank. Outside in the milky afternoon sunlight, fatigue overwhelmed him. All he wanted to do was go home and go to sleep. He got in his car and started driving. He was within sight of his apartment when his phone rang again. It was Jennifer, asking where he was.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I can't come today." "It's important, Peter, really."
He said he was sorry. He would call her later. Then Lisa, Herb Lowenstein's secretary, called to say that Nicholas Drake had been trying to reach him all afternoon.
"He really wants to talk to you."
"Okay," Evans said. "I'll call."
"He sounds pissed."
"Okay.
But you better call Sarah first."
"Why?"
His phone went dead.
It always did in the back alley of his apartment. It was a dead spot in the cellular net. He slipped the phone into his shirt pocket. He'd call in a few minutes. He drove down the alley and pulled into his garage space. He walked up the back stairs to his apartment and unlocked the door. And stared.
The apartment was a mess. Furniture torn apart, cushions slashed open, papers all over the place, books tumbled out of the bookshelves and lying scattered on the floor. He stood in the entrance, stunned. After a moment, he walked into the room, straightened out one of the toppled chairs, and sat down in it. It occurred to him that he had to call the police. He got up, found the phone on the floor, and dialed them. But almost immediately, the cell phone in his pocket began to ring. He hung up on the police and answered the cell phone. "Yes?" "It was Lisa. We got cut off," she said. "You better call Sarah right away." "Why?" "She's over at Morton's house. There was a robbery there." "What?" "I know. You better call her," she said. "She sounded upset." Evans flipped the phone shut. He stood and walked into the kitchen. Everything was a mess there, too. He glanced into the bedroom. Everything was a mess. All he could think was the maid wasn't coming until next Tuesday. How could he ever clean this up? He dialed his phone. "Sarah?
Is that you, Peter?"
"Yes, what happened?"
"Not on the phone. Have you gone home yet?"
"I just got here."
"So? Did it happen to you, too?"
"Yes, me too."
"Can you come here?"
"Yes."
"How soon?"
She sounded frightened.
10 minutes? "Okay, see you."
She hung up.
Evans turned the ignition of his Prius and it hummed to life. He was pleased to have the hybrid. The waiting list in Los Angeles to get one was now more than 6 months. He had to take a light gray one, which wasn't his preferred color, but he loved the car. He took a quiet satisfaction in noticing how many of them were on the streets these days. He drove down the alley to Olympic. Across the street, he saw a blue Prius, just like the one he had seen below Margot's apartment. It was electric blue, a garish color. He thought he liked his gray better. He turned right and then left again, heading north through Beverly Hills. He knew there would be rush hour traffic starting at this time of day, and he should get up to Sunset, where traffic moved a little better. When he got to the traffic light at Wilshire, he saw another blue Prius behind him, that same ugly color. Two guys in the car, not young. When he made his way to the light at Sunset, the same car was still behind him, two cars back. He turned left, toward Holmby Hills. The Prius turned left too, following him. Evans pulled up to Morton's gate and pressed the buzzer. The security camera above the box blinked on. "Can I help you?" "It's Peter Evans for Sarah Jones." A momentary pause, and then a buzz. The gate swung open slowly, revealing a curving roadway. The house was still hidden from view. While he waited, Evans glanced down the road to his left. A block away, he saw the blue Prius coming up the road toward him. It passed him without slowing down and disappeared around a curve. So perhaps he was not being followed after all. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. The gate swung wide, and he drove inside. Holmby Hills, Tuesday, October 5th, 3:54 p.m. It was almost 4 o'clock as Evans drove up the driveway to Morton's house. The property was crawling with security men. There were several searching among the trees near the front gate and more in the driveway, clustered around several vans marked Anderson Security Service. Evans parked next to Sarah's Porsche. He went to the front door. A security man opened it. "Miss Jones is in the living room." He walked through the large entryway and past the staircase that curved up to the second floor. He looked into the living room, prepared to see the same disarray that he'd witnessed at his own apartment. But here everything seemed to be in its place. The room appeared exactly as Evans remembered it. Morton's living room was arranged to display his extensive collection of Asian antiquities. Above the fireplace was a large Chinese screen with shimmering gilded clouds. a large stone head from the Angkor region of Cambodia, with thick lips and a half-smile, was mounted on a pedestal near the couch. Against one wall stood a 17th-century Japanese tansu, its rich wood glowing. Extremely rare, 200-year-old woodcuts by Hiroshige hung on the back wall. A standing Burmese Buddha, carved in faded wood, stood at the entrance to the media room next door. In the middle of the room, surrounded by these antiquities, Sarah sat slumped on the couch, staring blankly out the window. She looked over as Evans came in.
They got your apartment?
Yes. It's a mess.
This house was broken into, too. It must have happened last night. All the security people here are trying to figure out how it could have happened. Look here.
She got up and pushed the pedestal that held the Cambodian head. Considering the weight of the head, the pedestal moved surprisingly easily, revealing a safe sunk in the floor. The safe door stood open. Evan saw neatly stacked manila folders inside.
"What was taken?" he said. "As far as I can tell, nothing," she said. "Seems like everything is still in its place. But I don't know exactly what George had in these safes. They were his safes. I rarely went into them."
She moved to the tansu, sliding open a center panel, and then a false back panel to expose a safe in the wall behind it. It, too, was open.
"There are 6 safes in the house," she said. 3 down here, 1 in the second floor study, 1 in the basement, and 1 up in his bedroom closet. They opened every one."
"Cracked?"
"No. Someone knew the combinations," Evan said.
"Did you report this to the police?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I wanted to talk to you first."
Her head was close to his. Evans could smell a faint perfume. He said, "Why?"
"Because," she said, "someone knew the combinations, Peter."
"You mean it was an inside job?"
"It had to be."
"Who stays in the house at night?"
2 housekeepers sleep in the far wing. But last night was their night off, so they weren't here."
"So nobody was in the house?"
"That's right."
"What about the alarm?"
"I armed it myself before I went to San Francisco yesterday."
"The alarm didn't go off."
She shook her head.
"So somebody knew the code," Evan said, "or knew how to bypass it."
"What about the security cameras?"
"They're all over the property," she said, "inside the house and out. They record onto a hard drive in the basement." "You've played it back?"
She nodded. "Nothing but static. It was scrubbed. The security people are trying to recover something, but..."
She shrugged.
"I don't think they'll get anywhere."
"It would take pretty sophisticated burglars to know how to wipe a hard drive. Who has the alarm codes and safe combinations?"
"As far as I know, just George and me, but obviously somebody else does too."
"I think you should call the police," he said.
"They're looking for something," she said. "Something that George had. Something they think one of us has now. They think George gave it to one of us."
Evans frowned.
"But if that's true," he said, "why are they being so obvious?
They smashed my place so I couldn't help notice. And even here they left the safes wide open to be sure you'd know you'd been robbed."
"Exactly," she said. "They want us to know what they're doing."
She bit her lip.
"They want us to panic and to rush off to retrieve this thing, whatever it is. Then they'll follow us and take it."
Evans thought it over. "Do you have any idea what it could be?"
"No," she said. "Do you?"
Evans was thinking of the list George had mentioned to him on the airplane, the list he never got around to explaining before he died. But certainly the implication was that Morton had paid a lot of money for some sort of list. But something made Evans hesitate to mention it now.
"No," he said. "Did George give you anything?"
"No," he said.
"Me neither."
She bit her lip again.
I think we should leave.
Leave?
Get out of town for a while.
It's natural to feel that way after a robbery, he said. But I think the proper thing to do right now is to call the police.
George wouldn't like it. George is no longer with us, Sarah. George hated the Beverly Hills police. Sarah, he never called them. He always used private security.
That may be, but they won't do anything but file a report.
Perhaps, but did you call the police about your place?
Not yet, but I will.
Okay, well, you call them. See how it goes. It's a waste of time.
His phone beeped. There was a text message. He looked at the screen. It said, N. Drake, come to office immediate. Urgent.
Listen, he said, I have to go see Nick for a bit.
I'll be fine. I'll come back, he said, as soon as I can. I'll be fine, she repeated.
He stood and she stood too. On a sudden impulse, he gave her a hug. She was so tall, they were almost shoulder to shoulder.
It's going to be okay, he said. Don't worry. It'll be okay.
She returned the hug, but when he released her, she said, Don't ever do that again, Peter. I'm not hysterical. I'll see you when you get back.
He left hastily, feeling foolish. At the door, she said,
By the way, Peter, do you have a gun?
No, he said. Do you?
Just a 9mm Beretta, but it's better than nothing.
Oh, okay. As he went out the front door, he thought, so much for manly reassurances for the modern woman. He got in the car and drove to Drake's office. It was not until he had parked his car and was walking in the front door to the office that he noticed the blue Prius parked at the end of the block, with two men sitting inside it, watching him.
Beverly Hills, Tuesday, October 5th, 4:45 p.m.
No, no, no!
Nicholas Drake stood in the Nerf media room, surrounded by a half-dozen stunned-looking graphic designers. On the walls and tables were posters, banners, flyers, coffee mugs, and stacks of press releases and media kits. All were emblazoned with a banner that went from green to red, with the superimposed words, Abrupt climate change, the dangers ahead.
I hate it,
Drake said.
I just fucking hate it.
Why?
Because it's boring. It sounds like a damn PBS special. We need some punch here, some pizzazz.
Well, sir, one of the designers said, if you remember, you originally wanted to avoid anything that looked like overstatement.
I did? No, I didn't. Henley wanted to avoid overstatement. Henley thought it should be made to look exactly like a normal academic conference. But if we do that, the media will tune us out. I mean, shit! Do you know how many climate change conferences there are every year, all around the world?
No, sir. How many?
Well, 47. Anyway, that's not the point.
Drake wrapped the banner with his knuckles.
I mean, look at this. Dangers. It's so vague. It could refer to anything.
I thought that's what you wanted, that it could refer to anything.
No, I want crisis. Or catastrophe. The crisis ahead. The catastrophe ahead. That's better. Catastrophe is much better.
You used catastrophe for the last conference. The one on species extinction.
I don't care. We use it because it works. This conference must point to a catastrophe.
Sir, one said, with all due respect, is it really accurate that abrupt climate change will lead to catastrophe? Because the background materials we were given...
Yes, goddammit!
Drake snapped.
It will lead to a catastrophe. Believe me, it will. Now make the damn changes.
The graphic artist surveyed the assembled materials on the table.
Mr. Drake, the conference starts in 4 days.
You think I don't know this? You think I don't know it?
Drake said.
You think I fucking don't know it?
I'm not sure how much we can...
Catastrophe! Lose danger! Add catastrophe! That's all I'm asking for! How difficult can it be?
Mr. Drake, we can redo the visual materials and the banners for the media kits. But the coffee mugs are a problem.
Why are they a problem?
They're made for us in China and...
Made in China? Land of pollution? Whose idea was that?
We always have the coffee mugs made in China for...
Well, we definitely can't use them. This is Nerf, for Christ's sake. How many cups do we have?
300. They're given to the media in attendance, along with the press kit.
Well, get some damn eco-acceptable mugs,
Drake said.
Doesn't Canada make mugs? Nobody ever complains about anything Canada does. Get some Canadian mugs and print catastrophe on them, that's all.
The artists are looking at one another. One said, there's that supply house in Vancouver, but their mugs are cream-colored.
I don't care if they're chartreuse,
Drake said, his voice rising.
Just do it! Now, what about the press releases?
Another designer held up a sheet. They're four-color banners printed in biodegradable inks on recycled bond paper. Drake picked up a sheet.
This is recycled? It looks damn good.
Actually, it's fresh paper. The designer looked nervous, but no one will know.
You didn't tell me that, Drake said. It's essential that recycled materials look good.
And they do, sir. Don't worry.
Then let's move on. He turned to the PR people. What's the timeline of the campaign?
It's a standard Starburst launch to bring public awareness to abrupt climate change, the first rep said, standing up. We have our initial press break on Sunday morning talk shows and in the Sunday newspaper supplements. They'll be talking about the start of the conference Wednesday and interviewing major photogenic principals, Stanford, Levine, the other people who show well on TV. We've given enough lead time to get into all the major weekly news books around the world. Time, Newsweek, Der Spiegel, Paris Match, Augie, The Economist. Altogether, 50 news magazines to inform lead opinion makers. We've asked for cover stories, accepting banner folds with a graphic. Anything less, and they didn't get us. We expect covers on at least 20.
Okay, Drake said, nodding.
We start the conference on Wednesday. Well-known charismatic environmentalists and major politicians from industrialized nations are scheduled to appear. We have delegates from around the world, so B-roll reaction shots of the audience will be satisfactorily color-mixed. Industrialized countries now include India and Korea and Japan, of course. The Chinese delegation will participate, but there will be no speakers. Our 200 invited television journalists will stay at the Hilton, and we have interview facilities there as well as in the conference halls, so our speakers can spread the message to video audiences around the world. We will also have a number of print media people to carry the word to elite opinion makers, the ones that read but do not watch TV.
Good, Drake said.
He appeared pleased. Each day's theme will be identified by a distinctive graphic icon, emphasizing flood, fire, rising sea levels, drought, icebergs, typhoons, and hurricanes, and so on. Each day we have a fresh contingent of politicians from around the world coming to attend and give interviews explaining the high level of their dedication and concern about this newly emerging problem.
Good. Good.
Drake nodded. The politicians will stay for only a day, some only a few hours, and they will not have time to attend the conferences beyond a brief photo op showing them in the audience. But they are briefed and will be effective. Then we have local school children, grades 4 to 7, coming each day to learn about the dangers, the catastrophe in their futures. And we have educational kits for grade school teachers, so they can teach their kids about the crisis of abrupt climate change.
When do those kits go out?
They're going out today, but now we'll hold them for rebannering.
Okay, Drake said. And for high schools?
We have some trouble there, the PR guy said. We showed the kits to a sample of high school science teachers and,
And what?
Drake said.
The feedback we got was they might not go over so well.
Drake's expression turned dark. And why not?
Well, the high school curriculum is very college-oriented, and there isn't a lot of room for electives. This is hardly an elective, and they felt it was all speculative and unsubstantiated. They kept saying things like, "Where's the hard science here?" "Just reporting, sir."
"God damn it," Drake said.
"It is not speculative. It is happening."
Perhaps we didn't get the right materials that show what you are saying.
Ah, fuck, never mind now, Drake said. Just trust me, it's happening. Count on it.
He turned and said in a surprised voice, Evans, how long have you been here? Peter Evans had been standing in the doorway for at least 2 minutes and had overheard a good deal of the conversation.
Just got here, Mr. Drake.
All right. Drake turned to the others. I think we've gone through this. Evans, you come with me.
End of CD 4.